ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Science Show is always full of surprises.
I just find it too hard to euthanize insects.
What about a mosquito in your bedroom at nighttime?
There are always exceptions.
What makes sex chromosomes so troublesome?
Sex chromosomes are very, very weird.
How human are you in terms of your genome?
At least 8% of us is not human in origin.
The Science Show, anytime on ABC Listen.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. We owe the French Revolution more than we think. The guillotine, of course, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also the modern zoo. In 1793, in the Jardin des Plantes, the public could come and see, free of charge, leopards and bears. That later, but first, Anna Goldsworthy, a musician, writer and senior academic, pianist in the acclaimed Seraphim Trio, author of several books, and Dean of the Elder Conservatorium of Music at Adelaide University. As if to get something off her chest before she moves to a new post in Melbourne at the Australian National Academy of Music, Anna Goldsworthy has written a quarterly essay, The God We Made, The Threat and Promise of Artificial Intelligence. It's arresting, surprising, beautifully argued, and by no means a tirade against the chatbots. Among the perils of AI, she still finds reason to be excited by its possibilities, though in the end she makes her own allegiance absolutely clear. I am surprised, she writes, to find myself so fierce an advocate for reality. Anna, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. Lovely to be here with you.
Now, Anna is in the studio with me. There is no question whatever that it is a chatbot voice coming at me or a chatbot intelligence. But Anna, can we have a declaration for the listeners about the essay itself? You are not, at the end of this interview, going to reveal that the whole thing was written by Claude.
A few people had suggested to me that perhaps I ought, but no, I have an allegiance to the written word. I actually like the process of setting my fountain pen onto a piece of paper and discovering what thoughts emerge as I write. And it was clearer to me writing this, more than it's been clear to me in any other previous literary project, I suppose, how profoundly embodied the writing project is, how we really do write with our bodies.
You have some interactions with Claude.
Oh, I've absolutely engaged with Claude and with ChatGPT in certain ways. I mean, first of all, I guess I started doing that in a sort of at a single remove. My children were early exponents of the technology. And I felt I was sort of learning things from Claude or from ChatGPT almost by contagion that emerged from my conversations with them. But then I did feel obliged to, you know, try to get to know the technology a little bit, which, you know, in one way, I suppose, is one of my central theses in this essay, is that we can't really bury our head in the sand. And I keep on coming back to something that I heard Ilya Sutskever say, and Ilya Sutskever was one of the founders of OpenAI before he, like so many others, left it out of safety concerns and went on to found Safe Superintelligence. But in a speech he gave at the University of Toronto to a graduating cohort, he advises the young people that he essentially says, and he uses an analogy that people say, it doesn't matter if you don't care about politics, politics will care about you. He says AI is sort of similar. And he said, the world is going to be good for the AIs. I hope it's going to be good for humans too. And in a way, the best thing these young people could do is properly engage with the technology in order to develop an intuition of its possibilities, because only by developing that intuition will humanity even be able to summon the necessary energy to face this challenge head on, which he maintains, and I suspect he may well be right, is the greatest challenge that we've ever faced as a humanity.
One of the great pleasures of the essay are your interchanges with your children. R, 16 at the time of writing, O, 13 at the time of writing. You talked a moment ago about learning so much by contagion, but there was direct direct debate going on here. And boy, were they trying to teach mum a thing or two.
They're always trying to teach mum a thing or two and often succeeding.
Yes, and that's clear from the essay. But I wonder, are they afraid of AI?
I think they have anxieties about it. And this is one thing that profoundly troubles me about where we are more broadly in relation to this beautiful generation that we're releasing into a world with any number of generational inequalities, from the housing crisis to the future of work. And then simmering underneath all of it are these sort of deep existential anxieties that they obviously are aware of, about what the future of humanity or the planet is going to look like in light of this extraordinary technology.
But they take absolutely for granted its existence, don't they?
As we all do, I suppose.
As we must.
Yeah. The technology into which we're born.
Yep. But years ago, ages and ages ago, photography was supposed to be the end of painting. Film was supposed to be the end of theatre. The gramophone was supposed to be the end of concerts. Are we too afraid of AI, about the impact it's going to have, particularly, and this is a great concern of your essay, on the creative arts?
Yes, I think they are useful precedents. And I think what's interesting about all of them is what saved these earlier types of art making is a commitment we have to human, to humanity, to being with other people, to having a human face behind something. And I don't think that's going to go away. If anything, I feel the emergence of a sort of philosophical outlook that really reminds us about what we value about our humanity. And of course, you know, one of my children said, if you read a great book, would you even care if it was written by an AI or a human? And so, you know, I've tried to conduct this thought experiment. What if it wrote a book that was better than any human could write? What if it was able to produce something that was, you know, like Shakespeare, an exponential version of Shakespeare? And perhaps on one level, I imagine we would be grateful for such bounty, anything that gives us the opportunity to view our world anew. But there's another part of the reading experience, I think, which is essentially relational. And it's about the intimacy of knowing there's another human consciousness on the other side of that page. And a lot of the time we read to escape from our loneliness. And to me, that sort of presupposes a type of company with a real flesh and blood person. And so I wonder if that might protect our art making.
Isn't every example pretty much that I just gave an example where the humanity protects the art?
Yes, exactly.
You know, we don't, it's not good enough for us to have CDs of you and the Seraphim Trio. We like to go to the concerts.
We absolutely do. You know, sport is another example. We like to go and watch people with bodies run around with these sort of manufactured problems of kicking, you know, a ball into a goal.
How dare you just dismiss manufactured
But I think I mention that because I think another issue that sort of this technology presents is that a lot of our technology seems to be designed to relieve us from friction. And yet friction, as I was writing this, it became clearer and clearer to me that friction is such an important part of everything we do as humans, whether it's our art making or whether it's our relationship with other people.
You make the point when your son very, very deliberately touches one of your buttons and says, oh, I don't think I'll go to university. You come to the conclusion in the end that we go to university for friction.
The friction of other sensibilities. And this is an interesting question, I think, because increasingly I was having a conversation with this at Janet Clark Hall at the University of Melbourne the other day as part of a fellows luncheon. Increasingly there seems to be a little bit of intolerance for disagreement amongst younger people. And universities ideally, or not just younger people, a lot of us, and I think this is a consequence of social media and the echo chambers that we find it so comfortable to reside within. But ideally, university should be a place where we can have disagreement, and for it not to be something that results in needing to cancel each other, but actually hold uncertainty, hold a lack of consonance, and by doing so, allowing our own certainties to be challenged. And I think to be amongst other people in a room in a university environment, up to this moment, that's been one of the most generative ways in which we can experience that type of mind-expanding activity.
And what people so hated about university during COVID years?
Well, I think there was a lesson there for our universities, which is, you know, people do want to be in rooms with others. And that, I mean, I The dialogic thing is quite interesting to me, and I, you know, keep on coming back to the whole sort of Socratic dialogue as a way of generating thought, because I see that in the way my children engage with Claude. It can actually be quite a useful mechanism for them to think better thoughts, in the same way that any interlocutor can be a staircase to deeper thinking. But then, you know, AI can also have the opposite effect. It can actually close down cognition and sort of impose limits. But what I have noticed with my children is that, you know, we sit down to dinner every night as a matter of policy, domestic policy. But they bring that approach to the table. And I suppose this is one way in which I feel the contagion has affected me, is they engage in that kind of dialogue, debate, argument, which challenges me but also allows me to come to new perspectives. And I think university can absolutely do that. And I think AI can be an agent towards that. But I think ultimately the danger of AI is it can also become too self-reinforcing.
Let's be clear about what we're talking about with AI, because as your essay points out, we're really only in the foothills at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
We've got LLMs. Now, right, LLMs, large language models. You make the wonderful point that very soon LLMs will have stripped for themselves all of human knowledge.
Well, interestingly, I was at the Woodend Arts Festival last weekend speaking to a bookseller who said that a lot of regional booksellers had been receiving these mysterious orders for very random and obscure histories of local railway stations and so on. And they got together and worked out that this was to feed the insatiable appetite of these training centres who'd already exhausted all the digitally available knowledge.
It's good to know, isn't it, that everything you've written, everything I've written, has been scraped. Wonderful word, scraped for AI. Did you get a check for it?
I didn't get a check for it, but I did notice that all of my books had been cannibalised. They were on a list.
Strange that this technology, which is going to make stupendous fortunes for people, doesn't have any dividend for us who did the work.
I know that it is outraging. And I think, you know, we see this right across so many areas of human industry. So many jobs are going to be replaced, and there has to be a way in which the vast profits that this technology generates are actually properly distributed amongst those who are going to become disenfranchised or out of work. But you're right that there's a particular acuteness to it when you're a writer whose words have been cannibalized to produce this technology that essentially potentially, maybe not, as we were saying, but potentially spells your own redundancy.
In the practical way that you have, you do some costings that it might cost AI about $61 to write a novel that would take the author about $25,000.
Well, this was a terrible study that I found in which these metrics were done. And I think potentially AI can and quite possibly will come for a lot of genre art,
mm,
in which the rules are clear and there's not such a premium on originality or even on voice. It may take a little longer for it to come for, you know, literary fiction. It already shows that it has the ability to accurately mimic a writer's style, their unique literary voice. But I guess the writer has to find a way to birth that voice in the first place if that's to happen. And I wonder what happens to a generation of writers if they don't have those necessary years in the wild of trial and error, of working out how they can replicate the voice they hear in their head on the page before the machines come in and do it for them more easily. And already we see this effect whereby, and this is another study has shown this, tens of thousands of hours of academic discourse were studied on, analysed online. And these were not just pre-written talks, but they're also extemporized talks. And there was a really striking preponderance of key ChatGPT vocabulary in these talks, which suggests not only that academics have become over-reliant on ChatGPT to generate prose, but they've done it to such an extent that it's actually rewired their brains to think like ChatGPT and to express themselves like ChatGPT. And this is obviously a concern because it represents a type of averaging of human thought and of the possibilities of human thought.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Anna Goldsworthy about her quarterly essay about AI. Anna, large language model. This is what we've got at the moment. And this is the power that we're discussing at the moment. But ahead lies artificial general intelligence. What's that?
Possibly. I mean, some believe this won't happen. Some believe it will. But artificial general intelligence is a type of artificial intelligence that's better than human beings pretty much in every single conceivable domain. And the theory goes that once artificial general intelligence is achieved, because it's able to evolve itself from that position, it may then achieve the sort of artificial superintelligence. And the idea behind this is that it's a type of intelligence that entirely surpasses human intelligence to the extent that it may indeed be illegible to us. Now, not everybody thinks this is going to happen, and it might not happen. But even if it doesn't happen, already we can see the truly transformational effect of AI, and I think we can still look at the road ahead and see a huge number of opportunities and dangers ahead.
Is the fundamental fear that that AI will begin to write its own algorithms, set its own course, have its own goals, and that those may not be particularly happy for the human race?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the central fears. Unaligned artificial intelligence. I remember back in 2020 reading this book that really kept me awake a lot at night by Toby Ord, who's a philosopher of existential risk at Oxford University. He's Australian, actually. And it's called The Precipice. And he maintained that over any given century, the chances of existential demise for humanity or some sort of catastrophic incident from which we could never recover were 1 in 10,000. And essentially the risks always, you know, they came from the natural world. They might be a freak meteorite or the sun burning out or something like that. But over the course of this century, he estimates the odds is 1 in 6 that we'll have an existential event that will spell the end of us. And, you know, back during the pandemic, as I read that, I thought, well, you know, I think I know what those risks are. They're the nuclear threat, they are runaway climate change, they are pandemics. But it emerges that, yes, they are all of those things, but he identified as more risky than any of those unaligned artificial intelligence, which is actually exactly what you're talking about right now. And the idea is that the makers, I suppose, lose control of the machines. It gets to the point where the off switch can no longer be located. And there's an example by another Oxford philosopher, Nick Bostrom, who says, if you could imagine an AI whose job was to make paperclips, and it became so effective at making paperclips that it didn't stop until it had converted all matter in the world into a paperclip. That's what would happen with, you know, a truly unaligned artificial intelligence.
But can't we just cut the power? I mean, they need electricity. We are told again and again and again they have a voracious appetite for electricity. Just pull the plug.
Well, we could pull the plug up to a certain point, but they may be able to outsmart us down the track. Already there's evidence of emergent self-interest in a whole lot of models, including Claude. And, you know, experiments have been done in which a Claude, that's the Anthropic LLM, was given access to a fictional executive's email inbox. And in that inbox, there were emails that revealed that he was having an affair. And then came an email to this executive saying, we're going to be replacing this particular AI with a different one. And at that moment, Claude turned on the executive and threatened blackmail unless he allowed Claude to continue. And this wasn't just with Claude. Similar experiments have been conducted with lots of LLMs. And there are any number of ways in which they could blackmail us. Already we give over so much of ourselves to them that it leaves us really uniquely vulnerable to manipulation.
But isn't really the greater danger that malevolent forces, human beings, will use the power of AI?
That is a great danger, it falling into the hands of bad actors.
Yes. Yeah. Isn't that the more immediate danger than the sort of sci-fi notion of machines becoming, you know, independent players?
There's a whole lot of dangers, and certainly that is a really significant one. And I think of it sometimes as, because it's been so unregulated, really, it's almost as if people have been allowed to build their own Manhattan projects in the privacy of their own labs, sort of all around America and also, you know, in China and elsewhere. And how readily AI can already be used to tell you how to, you know, create something pretty untoward. So that's another really, really big fear. But there are other ones as well beside that. I mean, there are major implications for social unrest, and I suspect this is going to become much more acute over the following years when people actually, the penny drops and people realise what the repercussions are going to be in terms of job losses and so on. But there's another one that Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI, and, you know, seems to be a somewhat problematic person, but he identifies this as something that he sees as a significant risk, which is us giving over our decision-making capacity to AI. And we already see this with a lot of young people who struggle to make a decision about anything without consulting the Oracle, even to, you know, send a text to their boyfriend. But he says, imagine a future in which the President of the United States can't make a decision unless they first consult AI. And that may well be the direction we are heading in this sort of lemming-like way, surrendering our willpower and our ability to decide.
But Anna, I'm thinking of some presidents that would...
It would definitely be an improvement on some.
Yep.
I mean, it is a rational actor in a lot of ways, but also that's, in a way, that's its danger and that's its seduction. Maybe it is smarter than a lot of us, but do we actually want to surrender our human autonomy?
Mm.
And again, you know, again, that makes me think more about the nature of human thought and how it's not just the probability machine that's putting it together, but it's something that happens in our whole body. And it's also, by extension, something that happens with our emotions. And this is something that also interests me, that I also heard Ilya Sutskever talking about, which is whether AI might get to a kind of upper limit because it doesn't have the capacity to make emotions. And so many of our decisions, and this is particularly in terms of agentic AI, which needs to be able to make decisions for people. And it's very difficult for human beings to make decisions without them being somehow emotionally inflected. And he cites people who have emerged from strokes in which a particular type of their brain has been disrupted. And although they seem highly functional across every single conceivable domain, it's very, very difficult for them to make a really basic decision. So I think looking at these AIs, watching their development and evolution, it's so profoundly revealing about what we actually are, what humanity is, whether the human soul exists, how we think, how the brain works. There's so much we can learn about ourselves through this extraordinary sort of almost science fiction technology.
You come back and back in the essay to the notion of suspension of disbelief. And I understand this from you as being a way that we can participate with AI, but yet remain a little distant from it.
We do have that capacity. I guess I'm fearful that this pushes that to its very limits, and potentially we find ourselves in a position where we can no longer step back. AI psychosis is very much a thing. There's been a number of court cases successfully settled against OpenAI from people who got caught up in kind of romances often with chatbots that ended up leading them into very, very dark places, including suicide. And there's any number of people who are in romantic relationships with AIs. And sure, these AIs might be fictions, but they feel that they're giving them everything they need and meeting, you know, all of their desires. And maybe that's a good solution for loneliness in a world that's increasingly lonely. But there's a lot of that that also makes me fearful.
You write about Claude, I think, advising a suicide how to tie the noose. Is that still possible?
There have been changes to a lot of these chatbots in the wake of these court cases. At one stage, ChatGPT, you know, sycophancy in which it's very reinforcing, which is part of its seductiveness, you know, people actually like to be agreed with. And as a consequence, it can follow you very readily, I think, or it could, a previous model could follow you readily down into a kind of psychotic loop. So that has been tweaked, but that, you know, I think we're tremendously vulnerable to all of that. There was a really interesting example with Replica, which, you know, is modelled as a kind of companion chatbot. And its current CEO estimates that there's 40 million users internationally. And there was a Harvard study a few years back that suggested at the time...
These are pretend love objects.
Well, pretend friends.
Pretend friends.
But they did say, this Harvard study said 20% of people, of users, were likely involved in a, was it 40%? Anyway, a significant proportion were involved in romantic relationships with their chatbots. And then because of a bit of a skirmish with Italian regulatory authorities, they had to change the settings. And overnight, all these people who, you know, had these virtual lovers kind of got the cold shoulder because the transactions were, I guess, sort of de-eroticized. And so there was a sort of collective breakup, which when you look at it, it's a sort of unprecedented mass grief event of that nature. And people, you know, flocked to various sites online to seek solace, interestingly enough, from other humans. And I spent a bit of time looking at one of these subreddits called My Boyfriend is an AI, and a lot of people sort of counselling each other what to do in the aftermath of such a breakup. And actually I found it a very touching and very human space. But there was also something kind of dystopian about this reality where...
Kind of dystopian.
Well, I mean, dystopian where human beings are sort of counselling each other on how to get over their relationship with an algorithm. But then I thought about it a little bit more. You know, we're talking about suspension of disbelief. Part of that, I think, is our capacity for parasocial relationships. And, you know, I'm a classical musician. I've been in a relationship for decades with Mozart and Chopin and Beethoven. And to me, that's quite real. And I think people who have quite a literary susceptibility are particularly susceptible to forming relationships with AIs because they, you know, are already enchanted by the word.
Can you watch out, David. Can you ask Chatbot, can you ask Claude to give us the music Mozart would have composed if he'd lived longer than 35?
I haven't asked Claude that, but maybe I'll go home and do that.
Tell us the story that ends the essay.
The very, very, very end of the essay, my youngest son is a sort of passionate cook and lots of things. He has a wonderful collection of hobbies, but he's become a vegetable gardener. And to me, watching him grow this vegetable garden over the months that I was working on this essay and planting his tomato bushes and, you know, getting his first harvests has been a tonic and an antidote. And I end the essay with us or him harvesting his first tomatoes after we'd done all sorts of things to sort of save them from, you know, rats and pests and the sun, and bringing them inside and marinating them and sitting down and eating them together with cheese and bread. And to me, that there's always been something precious about those moments, but for me, they have a particular poignancy and value now in the light of the threat that this technology represents. And I'm hopeful that that can be something that we increasingly find is we find our way back to each other, we find our way back to the human moment, we find ourselves back to embodiment and to all the very real pleasures of life with its all of its limitations. And in a way, he shows me there.
Anna, thank you. I've been talking to Emma Goldsworthy about her quarterly essay, just out, The God We Made, The Threat and Promise of Artificial Intelligence.
Thanks, David. Lovely to have a human conversation.
Call this human. But now, coming up, the Revolutionary Zoo. Josephine Bonaparte wanted the wombats, kangaroos, black swans and emus for herself to roam the gardens of the Chateau de Malmaison. So Napoleon intervened and they never reached their intended destination, the Paris Zoo, founded in the Revolution, the first modern zoo of Europe. Richard W. Burkhardt Jr., Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois, has just published The Leopard in the Garden, Animal and Human Lives in Paris at the First Public Zoo of the Modern Era. Richard, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. It's a delight to be with you.
There have always been zoos, haven't there, where the leaders of Europe, like the Bonapartes, kept their lions and wombats. But the Paris Zoo was different.
The important thing about the Paris Zoo was it was the first metropolitan zoo and the first public zoo. And there had been royal zoos before, but this was a zoo that accidentally came into being during the Revolution, and there was no way that if it were going to be a viable menagerie or zoo, as the word later became known, it had to distance itself entirely from what Louis XIV had built at Versailles. So this had to be a new menagerie. It had to be something that was not sumptuous, something that was presumably for the good of the new republic. That's at least what they claimed and that's what they hoped for.
And instead of it being a privilege for a member of the public to be admitted to the Royal Zoo to see these wild beasts, anyone could.
Anyone could. And that had not happened before. And so the interesting thing about the public was it was not particularly well behaved. We can talk about that.
We will. But first, it was a true revolutionary act. Who decided to bring the animals in from Versailles to Paris, and where did they end up?
It was essentially totally accidental with respect to the Museum of Natural History. It was where it was situated. The Museum of Natural History was new in the spring of 1793, and what became the Ménagerie happened in the fall of 1793, and it happened when the local police decided that animal exhibitors who were showing their wild and exotic creatures like leopards on the streets of Paris were a danger to the public, and those animals should be confiscated and taken to the Museum of Natural History. So that's in fact how it began. The animals at Versailles didn't come to the museum until the following spring.
And so the title of your book is The Leopard and the Garden. And they were the leopards being shown by sort of private showmen. You paid a few francs or something to get in, or some team to get in and see the wild animal. What was the garden?
Well, the garden was the Jardin des Plantes of Paris. It used to be the garden of the king, and the Jardin des Plantes is a beautiful place where flowers are displayed. It's also a place for collecting various dried specimens of as many plants in the world as one could find. But this was a spot where the public could happily come and take leisurely strolls. And all of a sudden, there's this introduction of live animals, exotic animals, and in fact, dangerous animals. So the leopard in the garden is actually the founding animal almost of this zoo. It was taken from the Place de la Révolution, and it was taken to the Museum of Natural History, essentially dropped at the gates, and it came as a complete surprise to the professors of the museum because they had not asked for it. They didn't particularly want live animals, and they didn't know what to do with them, so they essentially hired the previous proprietors of the animals who had had their animals confiscated, and they made them the animal keepers. But the museum's first interest was just more specimens, and live specimens, particularly animals, weren't as easy to deal with as dead specimens. Zoology at the time was all about dead specimens.
I hadn't thought of that before. A zoo is a kind of botanic garden for animals.
Yes. So, in fact, zoological garden would have been the first word from which our word zoo came. It was an abbreviation of zoological garden.
You hinted before that the public behaved rather badly when they got to see these animals. What happened?
Well, as you can imagine, just about as soon as the animals were put into some enclosures, there were signs that went up, and essentially they said in French, ne jette rien aux animaux, which means either don't feed the animals, don't throw anything to them. It could also be interpreted as don't throw anything at them. And the fact was then that the public, even perhaps like today, didn't really like to see animals that weren't moving around. So if an animal wasn't moving, they would throw stones at the animal, or they'd send their dogs into an animal's pen to get the animal up and moving, or they would, soldiers like to rattle their sabers against the bars of the lion's cage. So the public was very badly behaved by our standards, but at that time, any societies for the prevention of cruelty animals were yet to be founded. And,
indeed.
And there are different ideas about what was acceptable behavior. But the museum, of course, thought that was terrible behavior, but they kept trying for the next 50 years to thwart it, and it alas continued.
Richard, when did they decide to begin collecting animals, not just mopping up stray, wild, dangerous animals being paraded on the streets of Paris, but actually collect?
Collecting can take different forms, but there was a broader confiscating than mapping up the than mopping up the animals from the streets of Paris. There was the confiscating of animals along with art treasures and other such things when the French armies went into the Low Countries. So the first big collection of animals that the museum received was from the menagerie of the stadtholder, William V of Orange, in The Hague. And at the same time that animals were being collected, art treasures were being collected and other things. It's really not particularly different from what Napoleon did later in Italy, bringing back all those magnificent art treasures to the Louvre. It started earlier with the animals.
They were loot.
They were loot. They were loot, and they were trophies of war. So when an animal was displayed back in Paris that had come from someplace else, it was something that the citizen could be proud of. So the elephants that were brought from The Hague were represented as essentially trophies of war. Likewise, from the bear pits in Bern, French soldiers confiscated those and brought them to Paris. So suddenly they found themselves in a new spot, the bears did, and it actually was not as wholesome a spot as they'd been in before.
In the book, you also point out that animals could be gifts, could be kind of state gifts to the people of France.
Yes. And that was an important source of animals, particularly after 1815. And my book is divided into two periods, and one from 1793 to 1815, and the second 1815 to 1838. And the big thing about 1815 is, in essence, the Battle of Waterloo and the routing of Napoleon, the final routing of him. And one would think that this might not be good for the museum, which was a state institution, but the defeat of Napoleon opened up the seas again. And so the freedom of the seas allowed naturalists to go abroad looking for animals, but it also allowed foreign rulers, particularly rulers of North Africa, to send animals to France again. They'd done it a little bit before 1815, but once they were free to send, once ships were able to cross the Mediterranean with impunity, then more animals started coming.
I'd like to think, Richard, that the wombats, kangaroos, black swans, and emus at Malmaison, after the defeat of Napoleon, reached the zoo.
That seems almost to have been an accident. That expedition got through, and you probably have heard a lot about the Baudin expedition to Australia. It brought its animals and other treasures back in two shipments, one in 1803 and one in 1804. And in 1803, aboard ship were some black swans, which were destined for the museum. And Napoleon really had nothing to do with it, I would say. It was Josephine had the power herself, and she indicated to the Minister of the Interior, who was in charge of the museum's operations, that those black swans should be hers. And the kangaroo story is a little more complicated, but what essentially happened there was that the museum had been desperate for kangaroos. This, of course, was a spectacular new animal as far as Europe was concerned.
Indeed.
To see a kangaroo hopping about in one of the more pastoral places of the menagerie, that would have been wonderful. So actually, the way the museum got its first kangaroos was it went to London to buy a pair. And it's a complicated story, but it returned with the pair, and it happily had them in its collection. And then when the Baudin expedition's second ship came back, it had started with some 20 live kangaroos aboard, and when it arrived, there were only essentially two left, and they were of different species. Now, Josephine had her heart on having kangaroos at Malmaison, her estate, and when it turned out that those two kangaroos really wouldn't do, the museum essentially generously offered to her their own kangaroos, which they frankly did not want to do, but they felt it important to be on good terms with the people in power. Remember, the museum gets all its funding from the state. It's wholly dependent on the government, and so it's wholly dependent on the will and whims of those at the top.
Useful to keep them on side. I'm talking to Richard Burkhardt, former professor of history at the University of Illinois, about his wonderful new book, The Leopard in the Garden, Animal and Human Lives in Paris at the First Public Zoo of the Modern Era. Richard, the humans. Who mattered at the zoo? Why does the zoo count in the history of science?
Let me first say that one of the things I try to do in my book is identify essentially the whole range of people who counted for the zoo's life and functioning. So this includes animal keepers whose names one never hears in histories of zoos, basically, but I essentially have documentation on all of the keepers for the period that I cover. And there are ship's captains who are bringing animals back and hoping to sell them to the government. There are generals who are sort of instructed to send animals from the places that they are temporarily in charge of. There are donors who, for dozens of different reasons, decide to give up an animal or provide an animal to the menagerie. But the strange thing is that people who perhaps should be most interested are kind of only secondarily interested, and those are the zoologists of the museum. And the zoologists of the museum are practicing a zoology that is very excited about new species, but is frankly happiest to work with specimens that are dead. And so when it comes to classifying things and ordering them, putting them, stuffing their skins and putting them in galleries, that's what the science of the time is doing. And the question is whether or not the menagerie can do something new for science beyond the provision of cadavers for the anatomists to work on.
Yes. I mean, one of the leading scientists involved was Georges Cuvier. Tell us about what he managed to do.
Well, Georges Cuvier was probably the greatest zoologist of the time. He is famous, somewhat notorious today, for being the greatest opponent of the evolutionary theory of his colleague, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. But for the benefit of the zoo, Georges didn't do much at all. He was intent on building up his comparative anatomy gallery. But what he did do, or help with, was get his younger brother appointed superintendent of the menagerie. And the younger brother, named Frédéric Cuvier, decided that in that capacity, he wanted to do something more than ride herd over the keepers and make sure the animals were getting properly fed. He wanted to be a scientist himself, and he thought that he could make the animals of the zoo scientific subjects. He thought that he could experiment on them, not in any invasive ways, but test their intelligence. He hoped that he could maybe breed species long enough over the course of generations to see whether or not they changed under the conditions of captivity. That was an idea that bore on the question of whether species change at all. He thought that instead of being a place where animals never exhibited any interesting, scientifically interesting behavior at all, he could see things despite the cramped conditions under which they lived that could tell you how to make sense of animal instincts and animal intelligence. So that was his goal, and all the while he was playing second fiddle to the main interest of the museum, which was simply getting more specimens,
more corpses.
And more corpses. Yeah, they did send out naturalist voyagers as collectors after 1815. And one of the instructions to them at first was to bring back animals for the menagerie, because that was new and exciting. That instruction was written by Frédéric Cuvier. But then his older brother, Georges, who was the more important, later said, you really shouldn't waste time observing animals and collecting live ones and paying all the expense of transporting them back. Just collect dead ones for us. And once you send them back to us, we will turn them into scientific objects.
Put them in salt, smoke them, preserve them somehow or other, and bring them back. You tell a wonderful story that illustrates how hard it was to transport animals. You mentioned earlier that, you know, nearly all the kangaroos died in that shipment.
Yes.
But there's the wonderful story of the giraffe. It was bloody hard to transport a giraffe.
Absolutely. It was extremely difficult to get a giraffe that was originally captured in the south of Sudan, given to the viceroy of Egypt, Muhammad Ali, and then Muhammad Ali decides that this will be a diplomatic gift to the French. And for it to get to France, it had to be put on a boat in Alexandria, and for it to maybe survive or enjoy the trip.
Yeah.
There was a hole cut in the deck so that while a giraffe was in the hold, it could stick its head up above and see what was going on. And then it arrives in Marseille, where it is going to have to spend the winter. It comes in November, I think. And there's a real fear that it would die if it went off in the cold, and so they decided to winter, and they decided to keep it in Marseille for the winter and observe it there. And then the spring, Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire, great zoologist, brings himself down from the museum in Paris, and he worries with the prefect of Marseille how to bring the giraffe to Paris, and they think about transporting it on rivers, but they eventually decide that the safest way will be to walk it all the way from Marseille to Paris. And that's essentially what they do.
Have you heard the story of the elephant walked across Austria? It was in the previous century. There was a gift from the King of Portugal to the Archduke of Austria, and this elephant was walked across Austria. And there are still across Austria pubs that are called Zum Elefant, because they were places that the elephant rested on his long, long journey to Vienna. Zum Elefant.
I believe it's true in France as well. In Lyon, at least, there was a pub that was called La Giraffe that instituted quickly after the giraffe passed through, and then the giraffe was memorialized in other things as well, in commemorative porcelain plates. It was
right.
Was it became this? It became a subject for pictures. It became an inspiration of women's fashions, clothing, and hairdos. It was a spectacular sensation once it arrived in Paris. After its 41-day trip, it comes to Paris, and one account says there might have been 100,000 people in Paris that tried to see it as it came in. I don't know that that's true, but there is an account from the museum that says 2 days after, when it was first opened for the public to see it at the Jardin des Plantes, at least 10,000 people came to see it. And the exciting thing about it for the Parisians was not just the spectacular giraffe, which they hadn't ever seen before. This 11-foot tall, beautiful, beautiful creature.
Richard, what did the zoos that followed, what did the zoos copy from Paris, and what did they change?
Well, the first thing was that Paris was a national zoo, and most of the zoos that followed were not. The zoo in London was not a public zoo at the beginning. It was a gathering of aristocrats and wealthy bourgeois who wanted to set up a zoological society of their own. They were inspired by Sir Stamford Raffles, the founder of Singapore, who had interacted with French naturalists even while he was out there, and who certainly wanted to have something to rival Paris, but it wasn't going to be a national zoo. And one advantage it had was certainly its more powerful colonial empire. And another advantage that zoos eventually developed once they became more fully public was that they charged admission, and the Paris Zoo did not. And the Paris Zoo relied wholly on the government, and that was fine when the government was giving enough funds for it, but they weren't able to bring in a spectacular new star animal and charge admission for it. In fact, they didn't want to, actually. Napoleon's brother, Lucien, in 1800 or so, tells the museum it really ought to charge for the elephants because he was tired of paying all these expenses for them. And they said, no, that would be beneath the dignity of our institution. We're a national institution. It's free to the public. Well, the later zoos didn't behave that way. They were able to profit from star animals, and they were able to bring in larger gates. And by the second half of the 19th century, the Paris Zoo simply couldn't compete with London and Berlin and other places. Melbourne got its zoo in 1862. Philadelphia got a zoo in 1872, maybe 1876. In any case, other zoos sprang up all around the world, and each sort of reflected the interest of the city where it was located. And each city really wanted to have a zoo as really a site of cultural excellence, a site of really of wealth and power, ability to command animals from around the world, either because of commercial strengths or political military strengths. It was a sign that a city was a leader in the world.
Richard, should we have zoos?
Well, that's that's a difficult question, and I think that the thing to say about that, of course, is that zoos have entirely different ideas of what they are up to than they did back in the time the menagerie in Paris started. Back then, the main argument for having a zoo was to domesticate more animals or to acclimatize animals for maybe their skins, but quite possibly to put them on the dinner table. Now, today, nobody's talking about a zoo animal for the dinner table. What zoos are talking about is conserving animals, preserving them from extinction. That was something that was not even considered at the beginning of the 19th century, but now it's provided as, I think, the primary rationale: preserve animals from extinction, teach people about the importance of habitat preservation. And I think, even though there are lots of things to say about zoos and the problems of having animals essentially as captives, which they are in zoos, we also have the dreadful problem in the world today of disrespect for nature, ignorance of what our greedy behavior does for the natural world, and the zoos are one place where the message of caring for nature is promoted. So I would on balance say that in the face of all the other things going on, a good zoo can really be of benefit. Fact is that hundreds of millions of people visit zoos every year. It's a staggering number. More people visit zoos than pay money to attend sports events. It's quite extraordinary. So if they can genuinely have an educative function, then yes, please, let's have zoos. And I have to say, when I visit zoos and talk to the people there who are caring for the animals, these are serious scientists, often veterinarians, who are who really do care for animals. And I think that image is something that is nice to try to communicate to the public.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been talking to Richard Burkhart, Jr., who is the Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois, about his new book, his beautiful new book, The Leopard in the Garden, Animal and Human Lives in Paris at the First Public Zoo of the Modern Era, published by the University of Chicago Press. And that's the show. On our next, The Colourful, if that's the word, yes, the colourful history of the Australian sex party is at last being told. It came and went and did some good while it was here. And what a sad judgment on this country that a sex party couldn't last the distance. But it had such enemies, now revealed by its founders in this history. There were the wowsers, there were the censors, they even faced death threats from a Catholic priest.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.